First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's a great pleasure for me staying here in this week. Thank you. So today I'm going to talk about this special decomposition, a very special decomposition of a particular polytope, which is called the metrophase polytope. And this is joint work with my former PhD student, Vanessa Chatelain. So I don't know if you are familiar with this matrix theory. So let me spend a couple of slides by collecting some notions so you will be comfortable, more comfortable anyway, in order to follow the rest of the talk. So let me start with basic definition of a matrix. Well, what a matrix is? It consists of two things. The first is the finagram set that we will denote by E, and the elements are 1 up to n. We're going to just to have a look at the finite case. And then we're going to have a subset of E that we call undependent sets that verify these two properties. Now, the first property says that if I have an element in the collection, then any subset of this element also will, of this set will also an element of the collection. This is just a sample complex, right? And the second condition says, which is a little more difficult, that if I take two elements of the collection and one of these sets contains more elements than the other one, then I can find an element here, which is not in I, that I can add it up to I and all these sets still in the collection. Right? That's the basic property, one of the main actions in matrix theory. Right? So I have a big set and small set. There's one element here, which is not here, that can I add it up there, such that this set is also in the collection. That is actions for matrix. Now, matrix can be defined in many different ways. Dependency and undependent sets or ranks, closures, lots. One important notion that we were looking at here are the bases. The base is just a maximal independent set, right? So among all these sets in this collection, I'm going to take the maximum one. And it turns out that if I have a look at this collection, the collection of bases, they have this axiom that we call the basic chain axiom. What does this axiom say? Well, it says that if you take two bases, then and you take one element which is in one base but not in the other one, then there is another element in the second but not in the first, such that I can swap this element by this new one. And what I want to obtain is also a base of the matrix. Right? So I can change two elements. We have some properties for the bases. The first one is that any base, any independent maximal set, has the same cardinality, say R. And in that case, we say that this matrix has rank R, which is just the cardinality of one of the maximal independent sets. We can define matrix by using this rank. We have the same axiom. They are all equivalent, right? Okay. A few examples. A very basic one is what we call the uniform matrix, which consists of you take your ground set, 1 up to n, and then your undependent sets are going to be all the subsets such that the cardinality is less than or equal to R. You essentially have all what you have less than or equal to R, right? The bases here are actually those independent sets which are equal to R. Well, that's a very, very easy one. You can check exactly the properties, the axioms, change axiom or the other property for independent sets. Let me give you a second example. This example is the way the matrix burns, actually. I give you, you consider any field, and then you have a matrix where entries are over this field here. And you consider the columns of this matrix, right? And then these columns are, they have some index. So these index are actually my ground set for the matrix. And I say that any subset of this index will be independent if the corresponding columns are linear independent. just a, you know, basic linear algebra. Right? So, well, that belongs to this thing that there is one here and one there, we can swap. Well, you know, this is just basic linear algebra. When a metric, we say that a metric is representable of the field F, if actually it's a linear metric with a matrix A, but taking linear dependencies over for that field. But in that case, we say, well, the matrix is representable over F. Of course, we have matrices that are not representable over F, or they are representable over some fields, but not all of them. Another example, the graph. Given a graph, then you consider a set of vertices, a set of edges, and then here, the edges will be the elements of my matrix. And I say that the independent sets, any subset of edges, will be independent if actually this set of edges is a forest. That induces a graph which is a forest that do not contain cycles. Right? Is that clear? Yeah. So you can think, I don't know, take K4. There you go, K4. And then you have elements 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You have 6 elements. And I say, well, there's no. If I take this element here and this element there, 2, 5 is an independent set because the corresponding edges form a forest. There are no cycles. Right. And, for instance, that will be a base, because it's a maximal forest. If you add up any other edge, you will form a cycle. So it's a maximal forest. So it's a maximal dependent set. So that's a base. So actually, bases correspond to spanning trees in graphs. So if I, and then if I have another base, for any other base here, on the same thing, you take any other one. You can check that you take whatever this edge, whatever of these three edges, you can find one edge here such that you can swap it, right? And then form another spanning tree of that. Well, you can see it. So there are lots of examples. I just mentioned the very basic ones, but there are what we call the transcendental matrices. Transversal matrices. Well, there are lots and lots of different classes. Now, this subject turns out to be very, very handy because there are applications. Probably the first application of matrices theory has to do with graphs and combinatorial optimization problems. But it turns out that then later on, this subject appears in many different other areas of mathematics, like null theory, apophysics, polytopes. Cryptography, who would say it? Right? And there are lots of different notions like error polynomial that are very closely related with matrices. I could explain any of this, but I don't have time. But if you're interested, I'd be glad to explain. Well, recently, there is another application, and for that, I'm going to introduce what a base matrix polytope is. For this, then, you consider a matrix M. There you go. And then, for each base, you're going to consider the characteristic vector of this base V. What that means, you have your matrix, you have N elements. So I'm going to form, for each base, a point in N-dimensional space. How do I do that? Well, you give me the base, and I have a look at the I coordinate. If this element I is in the base, it will be 1, 0 otherwise. Then for each base, I have a point. I do the same thing for every single base, and I'm going to take the convex hull of the whole thing. That gives you a polytope. Right? And this is what we call the base polytope of a matrix. This polytope was first built by Jack Hammonds in the 70s, and since then we've been looking for lots of different properties and application of this polytope. Let me just say a couple of remarks of this polytope. The first is, even if the polytope is defined in the n-dimensional space, actually the dimension of the polytope is not bigger than n-1, right? That is, that there is an upper plane in the n-dimensional space that contains that polytope. You can probably figure out which upper plane it is. If you take x1, x2 plus xn equals r, where r is the rank, certainly each of these points verifies that equation, because you have r, exactly r1s, right? So that means that all the points live in this upper plane. So it cannot be bigger than that upper plane then. The dimension is almost n minus 1. But it is not exactly n minus 1. Normally it's lower than that, even if it's defined in bigger dimensions. But actually we can calculate the dimension of this point. We don't need it, but we can do it. And the second thing is that actually we can play the same game, but instead of considered bases, we're going to take independent sets. Exactly the same game. We have the characteristic vectors for each independent set and form the point. It turns out that actually this polytope here is one of the faces of this bigger polytope. That's important and it's very interesting. Okay. So that's, I don't know if I have, there you go, I have an example. That's uniform matroid, four elements, rank 2. Then I said the uniform matroid has all, any 2 subset is a base. So I have to take all 2 subsets of the 4 elements. There you go. And if I have the construction, for the construction, I'm going to come down with this part of here. One thing that I have to notice and that we use is that actually 2 bases here, and in general, 2 bases of the matroid, then the corresponding vertices are joined by an edge of this polytope, if and only if the symmetric difference of these 2 bases is equal to 2. So there is just one way to do this exchange action, element action, right? Because there are the symmetric difference is equal to 2. Right. So for instance here you have, well, this is a very small example, but just differ of 2 and 4 and the rest are the same. So the only way to go from there and there is exchanging 2 and 1 and 10 ones, one of these edges here. Okay, that's important. Okay, so now I'm going to define this special decomposition. This special decomposition, and I will explain why we're looking for this. Well, the formal is written that way. The problem is better just look at me and say, you take the polytope, and we want to split up or decompose this polytope in a smaller polytopes in such a way that the union of all of them gives the big one. But also, and what is important, is that each of these small polytopes is also a base matroid polytope. It's not any polytope. It should be a base matroid polytope. And the intersection of 2 of them also is a base matroid polytope. Right? So we want to decompose this into smaller polytopes, but not any smaller polytopes, but polytopes that correspond to the base matroid polytopes for some matroid. Right. Just some notation, some definitions say, if such a decomposition exists for at least 2 smaller polytopes, then we say that this big polytope is decomposable. It is undecomposable otherwise. And in the case and it is decomposed with exactly 2 polytopes, then we say that there is an upper plane split. Right? Because there are just 2 polytopes and there is an upper plane that separates. Good. Now, why do you look for this? And the reason is because Laurent Lafog, then Phil Meadows, 2002, actually in his work, he was looking for this compactification of sugar, fine sugar cells for the Grassmannian. And it turns out that such a compactification exists if a corresponding pellet of matter, a matter that we're going to associate with a Grassmannian, is undecomposable. Right. That's a very, very nice characterization. I had opportunity to talk with him, and he explained to us that he didn't know of any undecomposable polytope, and that he knew two examples with five elements of polytopes that admit some decomposition, right? But didn't know anything else. The question is, can we do something about it? Can we, say how, when we can have decomposition and how many decompositions, or when it is undecomposable? Well, another thing is, in the other way around, this work implies this nice results concerning matrix. That if you have a matrix which is representative of a vector over the field S, dimension R, with R again is the rank of the matrix. If the corresponding polytope is undecomposable, then M somehow is rigid, which means that they will have finally different representations up to scalings and some actions of the group, the bilinear group. Okay, so that is actually Laurent was who introduced this decomposition. And in his work, actually, he found himself the matrix, the object. He didn't know about it, actually. And that's why we got interested in this decomposition problem.
Is there a way we can learn what that means?
Well, there's a... there is a book.
Do you know what it means?
No. He has written a book, which I suppose we can learn how he used it, right? I haven't done it yet, but probably I will. Anyway, there's a book. It's in French. But it turns out that, well, he gave this definition because of this work, that it turns out that this decomposition is helpful for other things. For the study of different things like model spaces, tropical neural spaces, and some certain matrix functions, behavior. So it turns out that actually this decomposition is not only good for that, but very good for studying some other different things. For instance, here, these matrix functions like behave like violations means that if you have a nice one of these decompositions, then you can calculate functions like Erhard function or Todd polynomial function by doing this including excluding principle, right? So that's a recent application which I am interested in. But anyway, there are some other applications. So now, let me come back to recent results, what we know about decompositions. The first result is due to Kapraminov. Actually, he didn't prove that, but his work implies this result that says that if you take any rank two matrix, then any decomposition can be achieved by sequences of splits. So even you have several bits, several small polytopes, you can achieve by taking one split and another and another and another. This is not always the case. 2009, Milera, Gi, and Reina proved that there's a round tree matrix of six elements. You can have this 3D composition, but you cannot achieve it with upper plane splits. So upper plane splits are not enough. They might be good, but not enough. You cannot achieve everything by doing that. And also they gave five examples of, again, rank three matrix on six elements which the corresponding matter are undecomposable. And that's the only thing we knew about it, about decomposition. So let me explain you what we have done about. For this, I'm going to introduce a more combinatorial decomposition. I'm going to explain what is this, and I'm going to see the relation to this combinatorial decomposition and the geometric decomposition. We will see that they are not equivalent, right? But we are still looking for this base, for this combinatorial decomposition. And we reinforce things in order to have that this combinatorial decomposition is actually a good geometric decomposition. That is the idea. Now, the basic composition, you see, you have your polytop before, you have these smaller polytops. You're actually partitioning the sets of the big polytop. But the sets are the bases, right? So now I'm going to play the same game. I'm going to have all the bases of the M, natural M. I'm going to have a partition. Well, it's not really a partition, sorry. It is just, I'm going to have subsets, collections of subsets of bases, such that the whole thing gives me the whole bunch of the bases of the matter of M, in such a way that each collection and each intersection of this of two collections is still collection of the bases of a matrix. Right? So now we're talking about the bases. Forget about a little bit the polytop. And then again, I'm going to give you an example. Probably it's going to be more precise. We say that it's combinatorially composable if it admits such a decomposition. And certainly we need something which is non-trivial decomposition. That means that at least one of these classes, one of these collections is different from the whole thing, right? So it's a real decomposition. Now, it is clear that if I have a geometric decomposition, I'm going to have a combinatorial decomposition, right? Because if I have this polytop, I'm going to have smaller polytops. Each smaller polytop I know that is the base matrix polytop, and therefore the corresponding bases are the bases of a matrix. So I just take the corresponding bases for each polytop, and that will give me the combinatorial decomposition. Fortunately, the other way around it is not true. It is not because I have a combinatorial decomposition that I'm going to have a geometric decomposition. That is an example. If you consider this set of bases, you can check that these are really set of bases of a matrix. You have this exchange action. You consider this partition here, M1, M2, again, you may check that this is a matrix, all this is a matrix. And then you have a look at the intersection, which consists of just one base. It's again a matrix. So that's a good combinatorial decomposition. However, the corresponding polytops induced by these bases here, a set of bases, then the corresponding polytops do not decompose the big one. There you go. Right? So that's P1, PM1, PM2. All the bases there. But certainly these do not decompose the whole thing, right? Because the union do not give the whole polytop. Now, the idea of our work says, well, I'm going to consider, still considering combinatorial decomposition, but I'm going to give conditions in order to force that this combinatorial decomposition is a real geometric decomposition. Now, in fact, with this example, we can see what it is missing here is, well, that do not give the whole polytop. But essentially, it is not do not give the whole polytop because there are edges that do not belong to one of the smaller polytops. But in fact, what we need is that every single edge belongs to one of the smaller polytops. And if that is the case, then we claim that what we have is a real geometric decomposition. So there's a little bit of convex geometry. So just what I have just said is written there. And say how can we characterize that a smaller polytops actually is a good decomposition of bigger polytope? Well, she's going to have a look at the edges. You say, well, a couple of edges are one of the size, then we have this property in which it says that the upper plane divides down the polytope into two, and if every edge belongs to one of the sides, then the intersection, F is the intersection of the upper plane of the polytope, is given by the convex hull of all the vertices that are in the intersection of x1 and x2. So that means that actually it's a good partition, right? That's what says this corollary. Anyway, that's the geometric property in order to have good partitions. But now we have to give conditions in order to have good combinatorial decomposition. I don't want to, well, it's a little too technical, I don't want to understand all this, but just the idea that says that you give me the ground set A, this is a real partition of the ground set E. I'm going to have to look for this matter here. This matter is actually the matter induced by M, big M, just restricted to the elements E1 and E2, right? So if you're going to, just to keep all independent sets that uses elements on E1 and all independent sets that uses elements on E2, that gives you two matters. And I say that this partition is a good partition if you have these properties there. You can have a look at it, and I can explain it, but I don't want to spend much time on that. And the only thing we have to have look is this equality here. That's what we're going to use in order to prove that this combinatorial decomposition is a good geometric decomposition. And P2 actually uses it in order to prove that when we have this good partition, we can find matrix that we can find we can find a combinatorial decomposition of the bases in such a way that the corresponding collection of bases are really matrix, right? That's the second condition, and that's what we have done here. So if you take a good partition, you're going to define these two collection of bases for each base here. You're going to consider the basis such the cardinality is less than equal than this and less than that, and then we prove that each of these collections are really collections of a matrix. There we use P2. And then the main theorem says that if you give me a matrix and you have a good partition, then the corresponding polytope is a real upper plane split. And there we pass from combinatorial decomposition to the real geometric decomposition by using property 1, as you see. Right. So this gives you, conditions in order to be sure to have these upper plane splits. In fact, for a given polytope, which is you can have not only one upper plane split, but lots and lots, right? So well, we just define what two equivalent decompositions are. Essentially what says that the corresponding two upper plane split decompositions are equivalent if actually the two corresponding polytopes are combinatorial equivalent. And we don't want that. We want really different things. So when we don't have that, we say that they are different. Well, our first corollary of this theorem says that the polytope for the uniform matrix on n elements rank R has at least the number of the composition. And why is this? It's because we can form as good partition as that number. That's a small example again with this uniform of four elements rank 2. We have this partition, we have 1 to one side, 3 to 4 another one, and then I say this is a good partition by taking A1 equals A2 equals 1. That's a good partition. Then I'm going to take my BM1 and BM2 as defined as a dilemma. That's intersection, that's a partition. right? So for each 4, then we have this bit here, we didn't know it's a matter of that bit here, and what is in the middle is just intersection. That's good. Okay. So that gives me an infinite family of positive matrices that have made this composition. But they are not the only one. There are some other matrices, for instance, the lattice path matrix. This is a special class of transversal matrices. Transversal matrices actually were introduced by Jachemus again. So I don't know if you want me to explain this. It is not because we can see what happens, right? Essentially what it says that if you came in the grid and then you have two paths, the top path and the bottom path, each path is formed by either you go up or the right. You can go to the right several times or up several times consecutively, whatever you want, but just up and right. And then given these two paths, we can form a matrix. And actually we can detect all the basis of this matrix by considering all the paths which are inside these two ones. Somehow we can do this. I can explain details if you want, but anyway. So given this, I would like to have this a good partition. And a good partition in this case, and that's what is nice here, is just, it says that you just must consider one intersection which is inside this part, no matter which one. Well, here, just one, you may choose any one. And then you're going to form M1, M2, and intersection. M1, what is? It is very simple. You're going to keep this path here. Okay, this. You keep this. And this, you're going to follow this path up to where you get the same height of this point here. So I go up there, I get to this height there, I'm going to the point, I'm going up again to find again my path, and I continue with my path. That's M1. M2 is the same thing, but now I keep this here, and I send the same here. Follow my path until this intersection, go to the intersection, I'm going to find my path, and then continue my path. That's M1, that's M2, and the intersection is actually the combination of this one and the other one, right? The ones which are not fixed. So it's very graphical, right? That's the good partition, what it means in this class. And again, I have an infinite class of graphs having this upper plane partition, this upper plane split. Okay. The second theorem says that in matrix theory, we have this operation which is called the direct sum, which is denoted. It's denoted like that. That's the direct sum. Well, and the whole thing, all this bit here, is a matrix. The way it is defined is very easy, actually. You have a matrix M1 over a grand set E1, a matrix M2 over the ground set E2, and then you're going to consider all the bases here, and the basis of the union, of the direct sum, is taking one base here, union one base there. Right? And you want to do that with all, you have all the combination of the bases, and that gives you a whole bunch of bases which are the bases of this matrix there. And what we say is that if you want to know if this point has a non-trivial upper plane split, it is enough. It is characterized, actually. It is enough to have that one of these has a non-trivial upper plane split. We don't need that both of them has upper plane split. We just need one. Right? We can construct it, actually. Well, the second theorem, small remark is that the class of lattice paths, just the lattice path matrix, are close on the directed sum. There you go. You see, if you take one lattice path given this and given this path here, this is M1, this is M2, if you want to consider the direct sum, you just have to glue this corner here to this corner there. and all those hands are giving me the lattice path up. So if you want the lattice, you want to have an upper plane split here, it is enough to have an upper plane, one of these. But we know how to do this here. So again, we have more and more infinite family of matters having this upper plane split. Okay. Now, what was interested for, well, the interesting part for Lafort was actually in not having a decomposition, right? That's what he needed. So let me see what we can say about it. Now we're going to have a look at a class of matter, what we call the binary matter, that are matter that are representable over F2, field over two elements. Okay? For instance, graphic matters are binary matters, but not all matters are binary. Right? We have classes there. We're going to consider what we call the base graph of a matrix. The base graph is nothing else but the one skeleton of the base matrix polytope, right? The one skeleton that is, I just keep these vertices and the edges. That gives me a graph. That is the base graph. Mauder in 1976 actually characterized when a graph is a base graph of a matrix. Well, characterization is very difficult. It has to do with some labelings and stuff. But in particular, he proved this bit here, which is very useful. And he says that if you give me two vertices, which are at distance 2, then the set of neighbors of these two vertices are either a square, pyramid, octahedron. That is. So locally, the graph looks like that. Okay? There is a theorem in matrix theory that says that a matrix is binary if and only if do not have as a minor the uniform matrix on four elements of rank 2, U42. Now, minor, I have to define it. Minor is a matrix that we can obtain by using two operations that we call deletions and subtractions and contractions. I don't want to define it, but there is this characterization. What is important here is that we have seen that the base matrix polytope, the polytope for the uniform matrix of 4-2 is exactly that one. So, this characterization in terms of the graph says that if the matter is binary, then we do not have this in here because it's U42. And we know that there is no minus U42, if it is binary. Okay, so we use this. We use that actually locally looks like a square or this pyramid to prove the following lemma. And the following lemma is very simple, actually. And he says, you give me a binary matrix, and you're going to take a subset with the basis, such that this subset is a collection of bases of a matrix, right? So you have this whole bunch of bases, you can subset of these, but this gives me a matrix. Again, it verifies this exchange action. Well, if among this subset there is one element and all the neighbors of this element, then you don't have any choice. Actually, B1 is equal to B. If you want that B1 induce a matrix, you don't have any other options. You must have all of them. And that is because it's binary. Okay? So by using this, we can prove that then if M is a binary matrix, then the corresponding polytope cannot have an upper plane split. Because, you see, you have your polytope, and you have a split, then there's an upper plane here. You have one of the smaller polytopes. You have look one of these vertex. And then, because this polytope is of the same dimension as the bigger polytope, you must have that the neighbors of these vertices are mostly there. All of them must be there. But if there are all of them, then by this lemma must have the whole thing, though actually the partition is trivial. Right? In fact, we can do much better. we have that if M is a binary matrix and we have a vertex containing exactly the navels, where D is the dimension of the polytope, then the polytope is undecomposable. Then we need that, in other words, not simple polytope, but anyway, if we have a polytope in which one of the vertices contains exactly the navels, then it is not decomposable at all. Not 2 to 3 at all. And the reason is, you see, the reason is exactly the same. Suppose you have your polytope and you have lots of bits. Because this vertex is there, then you have your vertex there. And you have a polytope, the dimensional polytope, and you have the neighbors coming out from this vertex. Then you don't have a choice. If that is a polytope, this polytope must be of the same dimension of the whole thing. Right? So if you have this vertex somewhere, you must have the whole, all the navels. But if you have all the navels because it's binary, then you're going to have the whole thing. So that is a nice corollary that allows to consider the d-dimensional upper cube. We know that this upper cube is the base graph of a binary matrix, and therefore we can prove that, well, we obtain that if we have a polytope, which is the base matrix polytope of a matrix in which the one skeleton is the upper cube, then that polytope is undecomposable. Right? So that gives me again for an infinite family of undecomposable base polytope matrix. And that's what actually Lafar needed. Okay, I think a little bit too early, but I think I'm going to stop there. So there's time for questions if you like. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.